Hello again, Norman Olney back with To The Point. We'll be talking today with Scott Galloway. He's an early entrepreneur in e-commerce, now a professor at NYU, a podcaster, frequent cable news guest, outspoken critic of Silicon Valley. His latest book is Adrift, about what he sees as dangerous symptoms of American decline. First, though, we have Margaret Sullivan. She wants to see change in the way that news is reported in this country, and she speaks from experience. She was the top editor at the Buffalo News for 10 years, then spent 4 years as public editor of the New York Times. Now she's resigned after 6 years as media columnist for the Washington Post, and she's published a book. It's called Newsroom Confidential: Lessons and Worries from an Ink-Stained Life. Margaret Sullivan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
You argue that democracy is at stake in the midterm elections. You're hardly alone in that perception. But in your final column for the Washington Post, you say that the media face a real test. What do you mean by that?
I think we're at a hinge moment in American history in which our democracy is, arguably at least, on the brink. And it doesn't make sense to me to have the media conduct itself in the same way that it has been before all this happened. I think we need to center the coverage of what's happening in politics and government so that people recognize what the consequences are of these elections and the campaign to come. So not just to cover campaigns in the old sort of horse race, palace intrigue way, but to talk about how, you know, the threats to our electoral system are really important, and to really get people's attention. I don't think the news media should be asleep at the switch, as they seem to be in many cases.
I go way back. I was in television news in the Cronkite era before I got into public broadcasting, and we adhered to a standard which was adopted from newspapers. Some called it objectivity in political coverage. Others called it balanced. And the idea was that we would, you know, cover both sides of a given issue equally. I think a lot of people in the news audience still expect that, unrealistic as it may be. And you say that it's not only unrealistic, but that that pose, that posture, helped lead us in the wrong direction.
When we cover unequal things equally, things get distorted. So if we're covering democracy issues, you know, democracy candidates, let's say, or candidates who accept that certain things are necessary for democracy, if we cover them equally and give the same weight to anti-democracy candidates, we are not doing the public a service. So we have to make sure that we're not magnifying lies. We have to make sure that we're not magnifying and giving sort of the media microphone to people who are election denialists or who are planning to not accept the results of a free and fair election, or perhaps not accept and move on if they lose an election. I mean, we're in a weird state here. So taking everything down the middle and acting in this sort of performatively neutral way no longer makes any sense, in my view.
Let me ask you about a particular candidate running for governor of Arizona, who is, in fact, an election denier. She is Carrie Lake. She's gotten an enormous amount of attention. And here's what she had to say on CNN when Dana Bash asked her one of the questions you just raised.
Will you accept the results of your election in November?
I'm going to win the election, and I will accept that result.
If you lose, will you accept that?
I'm going to win the election, and I will accept that result.
Margaret Sullivan, what do you say to that? How do you respond to it?
Well, I think that Dana Bash was doing a good job of challenging her. And, you know, she's pretty clearly is saying if she doesn't win, she likely won't accept the results of the election. I mean, that is the way that, you know, that's the road to autocracy. I mean, this is a basic part of our democracy, is that we have elections. There can, of course, be challenges, but the challenges so far haven't turned up much of anything. But when the elections are over, the loser says, okay, I concede. That doesn't sound like what's going to happen here. And I think that that should be brought up and people should be extremely clear about it.
You said earlier that we ought to be very careful about anti-democracy candidates, but if they are running in a democratic election, how do you identify them that way? And how do you report what do you think people ought to know in addition to what they are saying?
We can be very transparent with our audiences, with our readers, with our listeners, and we can say, here is this candidate's stance on the electoral process. Here is what this candidate is saying about the 2020 election and how Trump is supposedly really the president right now. We need to be very clear and transparent with our audiences. And I think they appreciate and want that. They, you know, I don't think any of us want to live in an autocracy. And so we need to really make the stakes obvious to the people who are listening to us and depending on us for news.
I don't want to make this a program about Carrie Lake, but I can't help but go to the Vimeo that she has put out because it makes such a point of the fact that she once worked in the media herself, and that's something that has become a part, an important part of her campaign. Here's part of what she says.
The corporate media establishment flat out lies to people, and no one is holding them accountable. They exploit misinformation. They use it to manipulate the masses. They use fear-mongering to create a scared and broken population. It's right out of a communist playbook. I know this because I used to work for the mainstream media.
Here's a little bit more of that Vimeo and the way she elaborates on her own service in the media.
I worked as a journalist and a news anchor for 27 years right here in Arizona. So I know the ins and outs of the corporate media, and I know how corrupt it is. The network overlords craft a narrative. They pump it out to their affiliates, and all of the anchors parrot the exact same thing.
And then the thing that they parrot, Margaret Sullivan, is she has a television set, and you see a number of different commentators come on and say that democracy is at stake in this election, as if that's what's been dictated to them by their overlords. Here you are saying somewhat the same thing. How do you respond to that? How do we handle that as news people?
Well, you know, it is a difficult thing. I mean, we saw a lot of this during the Trump 2016 campaign and throughout his administration and in the later campaign. He uses the news media as a villain and as a foil. And so, you know, and the repetition around it is effective. I mean, he has turned people against the what I call the reality-based press. I mean, we can't necessarily fix it all, but we can make it clear to people that, you know, for example, there really were no valid challenges to the election. There were audits done, there were court cases, all of this, and they never came to anything. I mean, I think a lot of what she's describing, describes what's happening on Fox News. And I, of course, fault the mainstream press often. I mean, I'm a media critic. I see the flaws of the mainstream press, but I don't think it's what she's talking about.
Is there any evidence that, in fact, corporate overlords tell news people what to say?
I'm not exactly sure what she means by corporate overlords. I mean, much news media these days is a part of the corporate world. And I do see that as a problem. But I do not think that, you know, presidents of big corporations are, you know, calling up editors or producers and saying, here's what you need to say. I mean, there is a level of separation and of editorial integrity built into the systems of good news organizations. And I'm talking about the major networks, the big newspapers, all of those. I mean, there's a separation of powers. There's kind of a wall between the corporation and the editorial product. And that's for very good reason. So I'm not saying that journalists are unaffected by the fact that they work for a corporation and that there's a profit motive there. I understand that. It may cause them to, for example, you know, stress certain kinds of presentation or, you know, make things a little bit more sensational than they normally would be. But no, I do not think that corporate overlords are telling anchors what to say.
You were the public editor of the New York Times. Since you have left, they don't have a public editor anymore. What were your functions there? And do you think that they should be resumed at the New York Times and other papers as well?
So the New York Times was one of the places that had an ombudsman or ombudswoman or what they called a public editor, which was basically a reader's representative who was employed by that organization, by the New York Times, to kind of be an internal critic, to hear the complaints of readers and look critically at the content and ask questions and then report back to the readership on it. I think it was a really useful tool. It helped create a sense of accountability. The Times had overall 6 public editors, one at a time. I was the 5th. I was there for 4 years, and there was one after me. And during her term, the Times decided they were done with the role of public editor. I think that's too bad, but it's not unusual. The Washington Post, which I recently left, by the way, on very good terms and of my own volition, just because I wanted to do different things, teach and write books. The Post had an ombudsman for a long time and discontinued that role. So it's not as if the Times is all alone. But I think particularly right now, Warren, when we're having such a period of lack of trust in the press, lack of trust in the news media, that this is one way to sort of shore that up. And I am sorry to see those roles go away.
You say you want to be a reader's representative, or I presume a listener's or viewer's representative, if the same thing would apply in broadcasting. But what about those readers, listeners, and viewers who buy the idea that the news media are, in fact, corrupt, are some part of some sort of conspiracy? How do you represent them?
Well, I mean, I don't think that we can kind of coddle that idea. I mean, we have to do our job. Our job is to be reporting rigorously about what's happening in our world. And, you know, to some extent, we can't really control whether people decide they don't want to believe it. I am worried about the fact that as a nation, we don't really seem to have a common basis of truth or reality anymore. I mean, there is truth and reality, but it's not believed in by everyone. And, you know, it's really difficult to battle conspiracy theories and the belief in these crazy things, belief that things like the horrible massacre at Sandy Hook was a false flag, you know, made up thing. I mean, this is, we're talking about fantasy land here. So, you know, what can we do? We can report rigorously and accurately. We can hold ourselves to high standards. We can be transparent and forthright with our audiences, and we can do our job to the best of our ability. You know, beyond that, you know, it's very difficult to sort of wave a wand and say, oh, all you folks who believe that, you know, Hillary Clinton had a sex trafficking ring in a pizzeria in Washington, D.C., we're going to really try to talk to you. I'm not sure that's possible.
A lot of that stuff originates on social media. Should the mainstream media simply not report it, or is it possible to ignore it?
It can't be ignored. It has to be reported in context. You know, there's a technique that people call the truth sandwich. This is not my coinage, but the way it would work is not to magnify the craziness and then try to fact check it, but rather do fact, fallacy, fact. Start off with what is right, then go to, here's this crazy thing that's being reported, and then back to what's wrong with that, and here's, we're going to fact check it, so that it gives, you know, it gives much more context, and it doesn't magnify or get into the repetition that is so important to propaganda. I mean, that's how propaganda works, is through repetition. So we have to be very careful of our role in that.
What about the desire to build audience on the part of newspapers, broadcasters as well, and the need simply to get clicks? Certainly what's most sensational is what gets the most clicks. You say that that's not what we ought to start with. How do we resist the idea to, wait a minute, let's build the audience by reporting this outrageous thing?
Well, I think it has to be intentional. We have to know what our role is. There has to be leadership on it from the top of news organizations that, look, we're not going to fall into this trap, and to get everybody on board with how we're going to approach these things in a responsible way. And I see good things happening in news organizations. I see, for example, democracy teams being set up. I see efforts to do more fact-checking and more, less sort of broadcasting things live so that there's no opportunity to fact-check in real time. But I think we need to do better because there's just more and more of this poisonous misinformation that's circulating out there.
Is there enough coverage, do you think, of government and the things that people do once they are, in fact, elected, or the things that they don't do?
No, there is not enough. And, I think that it's a paradox. People will say, news consumers or citizens will say, I wish there was more coverage of substance. I would like to know more about the issues. They will say that, but then what is it that gets people's attention? Well, it's what you just said. It's the more salacious stuff. It's the more outrageous kind of things. So we do have to, of course we want to keep our audiences interested, but I don't think we do that through clickbait. We should not do it through clickbait. We should not do it through being, kind of fomenting this outrage. But we can make things interesting. We can make things engaging. We can present things in a way that interests people and still center substance, issues, facts, evidence.
If you watch cable news, you see now that cable news stations are covering each other. CNN covers the outrages that occur on Fox. Fox covers what it considers outrages that occur on CNN and other places. Is that healthy?
Well, cable news is an entity unto itself, really. And, it is because of its nature, which is 24/7, and it does tend to cater to a specific audience. I mean, people go there to sort of find their cohort of agreement. Yeah. It's kind of like somewhat of an echo chamber. Is it healthy? Not particularly, but it is also not going away. And it's not the only thing that, certainly there are lots of podcasts and lots of broadcasters and lots of people out there who are, the Alex Joneses of the world. So it's not just cable news where this is happening. But I agree with you that it is, it is a place where it's a place where people go to get excited about issues and not necessarily in the most productive or, democracy enhancing ways.
I think our audience would like to hear a little bit from you about your own career, because it really is quite remarkable. You took over the Buffalo News at a very young age and then graduated to these very, very powerful positions at two of the most important news organizations in our country. Tell us a little bit about your career, how you got started, and what you had in mind, and how things have changed.
Thanks. Well, I grew up in the Watergate era, and my family was glued to the Watergate hearings when I was a kid. And somehow that got into my blood, and I thought that the work done at the Washington Post by Woodward and Bernstein was very intriguing. So I got into journalism in high school. But I came to the Buffalo, then called the Buffalo Evening News, as a summer intern, and I did, over time, become the first woman editor of the paper. And it was a great honor because it was my hometown, and I got to lead a newsroom of 200 people and do some really, really important work for the region and the community. So I always think of that as the most important honor of my career. But I was lucky enough to go from Buffalo to the New York Times as public editor in this kind of strange role that you just described. And that is a term-limited role. It only lasts for a few years. So I had in mind that I would move on, and I couldn't think of any place I would rather have moved on to than the Washington Post, which inspired my career, and where there was a great and legendary editor, Marty Baron. So it was a great experience to go there and to be the media columnist, especially at a time when Trump was just coming into power, and there was so much to say, some of which we've touched on here, Warren, about how the media became this kind of enemy and, you know, became disparaged, and just the whole role that the media played vis-a-vis Trump was a very fascinating subject.
You described some interesting exchanges with Marty Baron on this issue that we talked about earlier about what some people refer to as objectivity. I never bought that one as a reporter, but maybe fairness is a better way to put it. How did you differ, and what did he have to say in response to your critique?
You know, Marty believes strongly in the idea of objectivity, and he has no problem with the word objectivity. And what he means by that, and I'm on board with this, is that we need to approach subjects with an open mind whenever we're doing reporting, search for evidence, be rigorous about it, and that's what we report back to the people. I am completely on board with that. I think where people get tripped up is in, you know, there's a whole group of people inside journalism that say, well, there really can be no such thing as objectivity. Everybody brings their own biases. Everybody brings their own experiences to the table. And I guess the idea is, to what extent are we able to set those aside and really do the job? So I think because the word has gotten a little bit fraught and people argue about it, I like to use the words accuracy, fairness, evidence-based. Those kinds of things, I think, may get the subject matter across without all the sort of static.
When I began reporting for a major station in Los Angeles, television station, in the early 1970s, there was one woman reporter on the staff. How are women doing, generally speaking? Your own career suggests they're doing pretty well.
Well, when I became editor of the Buffalo News, the paper was of 1,400 papers in the country, the News was about the 50th largest. So it was a pretty big paper. And we looked at, just because, you know, I had been named the first woman editor, I remember we kind of looked at the top 100 papers, and there were 13, I was the 13th woman to head a newsroom at these papers. You know, nowadays it's not at all unusual for a woman to head a news organization. So I think in that way, it's gotten much better. But I still think that there are a lot of hazards and problems for women. It's still a pretty misogynistic business in a lot of ways. And one of the really difficult things that's happened, something I experienced, is when you're a writer, and if you happen to be writing about politics, there's just so much online harassment of women, of people of color. You know, if you are in any way considered the other, there's just so much awful stuff coming at you at all times. It's pretty dispiriting. So in that way, it hasn't gotten any easier and may have gotten a little bit harder. But I think from a career perspective, a lot of the obstacles have been removed.
Well, there's some good news as well as some unfortunate news involved in what you say, but we'll focus on the good news for the moment. Back to the issue of standards in journalism. What about anonymous sources? How do you feel about those?
Well, I think they're overused. And this was a kind of a campaign I went on as public editor at the New York Times, was to try to discourage the overuse of anonymous sources, in which a story is based on someone saying something, but we really don't know who that person is. We might see that person called a U.S. official or someone close to the investigation, but we really don't know. And so there's not much accountability there. Sometimes that's necessary. There is some information that we can only get when we allow people to be confidential sources. But it's overused. And because it's overused, there's a decline in trust. We're basically saying to our readers or viewers, you know what? We're not going to tell you who's behind this story. Just trust us. And I'm not sure we always earn that trust. And then when that story turns out to maybe not be so true, well, who are we going to blame for that? There's no one then to go back to and hold their feet to the fire because we never knew who they were to begin with. And one of the ways that this happened, and people haven't forgotten this, is in the run-up to the Iraq War, you know, the reporting by many news organizations on the supposed weapons of mass destruction that existed in Iraq and that gave America supposedly a reason to go to war, you know, that turned out not to be the case. And that, too, was based on anonymous sources. And a failure of skepticism is something that people really remember and has sort of tainted their view of the media.
And the New York Times has been accused of leading the way in that regard.
Yes. I mean, the Times on that one was certainly a part of it. And certainly not alone, but, you know, people will often use the name Judith Miller to sort of symbolize all of it. But in fact, it was across the news media.
Sure.
So with a few very admirable exceptions, the Knight Ritter Bureau, in Washington Bureau, was pushing in the other direction, but they didn't have the sweep and the power of some of these really big news organizations.
Final question. You regard journalism, you say, in the time of democratic crisis as a form of activism. What do you mean by that? That sounds like something that people might shy away from for obvious reasons.
Well, I don't mean that we should be out in the street with picket signs, or I certainly don't think that we should be on any team in terms of being partisan. I believe in being nonpartisan. But I do think that at a time when there's so much misinformation and such a need for truth, that we need to sort of ramp things up with our desire to be a part of sustaining democracy, with our desire to be a part of getting the truth out there at this time. And so it calls for a more active role than simply writing everything down, taking everything down the middle, and serving as almost a stenographer. We have to be more intentional than that. And so that's what I mean.
I'm being asked to put one more question to you, which is this. You have said that if Trump runs again in 2024, we should try to avoid covering him. Is that correct?
No, can't avoid covering a major candidate for president. What I think we need to do is be careful about, for example, taking his rallies live, broadcasting his rallies live, because so much, you know, we know that there have been thousands and thousands of lies that he has put out there over many, many years, far more than is normal in politics. And so I think we need to change our coverage a little bit. Of course we need to cover what he's doing, what he's saying, and we need to put it in context. It's harder to put things in context when you're just broadcasting something, you know, in whole cloth like you would a live rally.
And the fact that somebody thought that is an example of how things can get distorted as they are passed around.
Right. So I'm glad to be asked about it. Good to set the record straight.
Glad to do it. You certainly have lived up to your credentials, and we're just delighted to have you with us. Again, the book is Newsroom Confidential, Lessons and Worries from an Ink-Stained Life. Margaret Sullivan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're going to take a brief break now, and we'll be right back with Scott Galloway. He's a millionaire who told me millionaires should pay their taxes. He almost predicted the resignation of British Prime Minister Liz Truss. Back in a moment with To the Point. Warren Olney back with To the Point. Our next guest is Scott Galloway. He's an early investor in e-commerce, business professor at NYU, columnist for New York Magazine, and co-host of the podcast Pivot with Kara Swisher. He's a frequent guest on TV and cable news shows. The New York Times says he makes $5 million a year from speaking fees. His latest book is Adrift, about the risks of polarization in this country. Now, Galloway has moved to London. And we talked before Liz Truss became the shortest-serving prime minister in British history, largely because of economic issues we'll hear him pointing out in our interview. I began by asking about a recurrent theme, the difficulties facing young American men.
Yeah, look, as you get older, you want to impact. You try and pick your punches and try and champion or be an evangelist for a group. And, you know, my group, if you will, is young men who I think have fallen further, faster relative to any other cohort in America.
Why?
Well, there's a variety of sort of biological, societal, and economic reasons, but it starts at a very early age. I would say the education system is somewhat biased against males. On a behavior-adjusted basis, boys are twice as likely to be suspended. So there's some societal issues there. Two-thirds of high school and primary school teachers are women, and it's understanding that they would champion girls naturally. You also have colleges, which will graduate two women for every one man over the next 5 years. 7 to 10 high school valedictorians are girls. You also have biological reasons. Males' prefrontal cortex that kind of manages the executive function just doesn't mature as fast, makes them much more risk aggressive, much more prone to kind of bad decisions. So you have a group of immature males that aren't graduating from college, not attaching to work, not attaching to relationships, not attaching to school. And the result is we're producing too many of the most dangerous person in the world, and that is a bunch of lonely, broke men.
In the meantime, do you get accused of being misogynistic?
Yeah, it's difficult to be sort of seen as promoting young men without it being immediately drawn to that means you're anti-women.
You
kind of offend everybody when you talk about men in this context. One, young men oftentimes feel like you're accusing them of being incels and equating them with mass shooters, so sometimes they push back on it. Women or feminists find the argument unappealing because they feel, well, you've had a 400-year head start. Where were you when we were struggling? And the group that you hear most from in terms of supporting this type of work or articulating this type of issue is one group, and that's mothers, who will reach out and say, my daughter's at Penn, my other daughter's at a PR firm in Chicago, and my son's in the basement vaping and playing video games. But yeah, you could definitely take some arrows for it.
Let's talk a bit about the book. Why do you say that America is adrift?
Well, I don't think we're lost. I think we still are positioned as the strongest nation in the world. We are food independent, energy independent. No one's lining up for Chinese or Russian vaccines. The most talented, hardest working people in the world all have one thing in common, and that is the majority of them want to come to the United States. Unfortunately, I think because of economic incentives around big tech that want to enrage us, to engage us, because now 54% of Democrats are worried about their kids marrying a Republican. A third of each party sees the other as the enemy. I think our media has been weaponized internally and by bad actors. You know, the horror movie, if it's playing out, is not Jason, someone with a chainsaw in a mask. It's the calls coming from inside of the house. We're tearing each other or eating ourselves from the inside out. But I think all of our problems, whether it's income inequality, failing young men, polarization of our media, I think all of these things were deliberate decisions or things we allowed, and I think they can be undone. I think they can be fixed. So I don't think we're lost. I think we're adrift. I think we see land. We can get there. I'm fairly optimistic. I think all of the ills that plague us are actually fixable. So we're adrift, but, you know, land is, we can see it.
In the book, you talk about two versions of American capitalism and what they've meant for the middle class, one in the years after World War II, the other in the years after Ronald Reagan. How are those versions of American capitalism different, and what's the importance for the middle class?
Well, I believe what Peter Drucker said, that an economy exists to create a middle class. You can kind of define the prosperity or the progress of a nation based on its middle class. The Chinese have added 500 million people to the middle class in the last 40 years. We've actually lost people. So the kind of pre-Reagan phenomena that would best kind of embody what's happened is that until the early 70s, as productivity went up, either through technology or management innovation, wages crept up almost pro rata. So wages and productivity look like two snakes intertwined, constantly tracking each other. And then something happened in the early 70s, whether it was Milton Friedman or shareholder rights campaigns, and that is wages went flat while productivity kept moving up and to the right. So literally trillions of dollars of surplus value that's been captured almost entirely by the shareholder class or the top 1%. And the result is a middle class that is sort of waning or anemic. and our tax structure has gone from being progressive to regressive, and our middle class is barely holding, if you will. So there's kind of phenomena where capitalism is lift yourself up by your boots, winners and losers, full body contact violence at a corporate level such that it can sit on a bed of tax revenues that we then show some empathy and redistribute and support the middle class, make big technological investments. But what we have lately is capitalism on the way up, socialism on the way down, where we bail out corporations, and the result of that is cronyism, where it's rugged individualism on the way up, and then when things go wrong, corporations say we're all in this together and ask for bailouts. I think we have the worst of both worlds right now.
Are you yourself, to some extent, a beneficiary of the practices that you are so critical of?
100%. I'm a beneficiary of a lot of things. I was born in California in 1964, which was hitting the lottery. I got to go to UCLA and Berkeley for undergraduate and graduate degrees of a total of $7,000. And not only was it economically accessible, it was accessible. The admissions rate at UCLA was 76%. Now it's somewhere between 6 and 9%. I came of age in the internet in the Bay Area, which put huge wind in my economic sails. I think I've benefited from being a white heterosexual male on very basic levels. My roommate my freshman year in college was born a white homosexual male, and he was dead of AIDS by 33. So a lot of my economic and personal blessings are not my fault, and I try and remember that. And I think a virus that infects our technology community is that they conflate luck with talent and are the first to criticize our government, which I think is the U.S. government, I believe, is the most noble organization in history. And I find that it's ironic that the individuals who are most patriotic are the ones who've invested the most, and that is our veterans. And the individuals who are least patriotic, in my mind, are the ones who have benefited the most. And if you find me a tech company worth over $1 trillion, I'll show you a company that sits on top of massive investments by middle-class taxpayers as guided by the government, whether it's in GPS or vaccine research or the Apollo missions or DARPA or the internet or even our roads or our post system. But I just think it would be impossible to ignore my blessings and recognize a lot of my success isn't my fault.
You talk about how Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Google, Microsoft, Meta have 20% of the S&P 500, enormous concentration of wealth there. And you're very critical of individuals. For example, Jeff Bezos, who you say makes the average salary of one of his employees every 10 seconds.
Well, look, I think we should have billionaires. I think we should have incentives to get rich. I think it's really powerful. I think capitalism is an agreement that we're going to have winners and losers. The question is, should CEO pay gone from 20 times the average salaries worker to 350? Should, once you hit 99 percentile of income, should tax rates go down? Or if you win the gold medal, you're awarded the bronze and the silver. So I believe in capitalism. I believe in billionaires. But does it make sense for individuals to be worth the GDP of a small nation, and then to pay lower taxes? And I think these are decisions we made, which we could undo. One of the myths about our tax code is that the poor and the middle class are the only victims here. Actually, the biggest victim, relatively speaking, in tax code is what I refer to as the workhorses. That is a couple making between $500,000 and $1 million a year, played by the rules, amazing jobs. They have to live in usually a high-tax urban metro to make that kind of money, and their tax rate is sometimes 47 to 53%. And they don't make enough money to have enough capital to invest such that they can move to capital gains. But I just don't understand philosophically why we've decided the capital that money makes is more noble than the capital that sweat makes. And also, the larger kind of rubric here is that we've undertaken a massive transfer of wealth from young people to old people. People under the age of 40 have seen their wealth go from 19% of GDP to 9%. Two biggest tax deductions, mortgage interest and capital gains. Who owns homes and stocks? Older people. Who rents and makes their money through current income? Younger people. So I think this is essentially a concerted effort to cram wealth in the top 1% and move wealth from younger people to old people. And these have not been accidents. They're not from forces outside our control. They were deliberate decisions, and they can be undone.
You are an entrepreneur yourself. You're obviously an advocate of the capitalist system, but you referred to the U.S. government as something that is noble. You said it's the most noble institution we have. What do you mean by that? It's very unpopular, right?
Find me someone who's really talented and vastly underpaid, and they usually work for the U.S. government. Find me someone who's overpaid and unappreciated, and they usually work in tech. We turn back fascism. We put men on the moon. We've created vaccines that, by most estimates, have saved 1 to 2 million Americans. You know, we invented the bomber jacket, silly putty, and we've done some amazing things with the U.S. government. It's why I'm here talking to you. I'm a product of big government. The generosity and vision of California taxpayers and the Regents of the University of California, respectively, are the reason that, you know, an unremarkable son of a single immigrant mother who lived and died a secretary gets to live the life I get to live. And there's nothing unique about it. It's accessibility to great education. It's an environment that loves entrepreneurs and capitalism. It's a progressive tax structure, and it's consistently making big, bold bets back into technology in the middle class that will pay off. And I think we've lost sight of landfall, if you will. I think we're adrift. But yeah, show me an unbelievable accomplishment that has changed the world, and I'll show you somewhere it links back to the U.S. government.
Are you concerned about deficit spending and what that costs, what it might cost the future?
Well, 100%. I'm here in London right now, as we talked about, Warren, and the first thing the new Prime Minister Truss enacted was a tax act that basically eliminated the top tax bracket at the expense of a deficit. You can understand the benefit around tax cuts, money going into the private sector, which can be more efficient. I get that. But when you don't cut spending, this sort of trickle-down theory of rich people, you know, our quote-unquote most productive citizens, will create enough growth to supplant the hole in the deficit. I mean, the U.S. has been a 40-year experiment in how that does not work. And I think the markets here immediately recognize it didn't work, and you've seen the pound have an unprecedented crash. So deficits matter. I've never bought this notion that they don't matter on the far left. They talk about modern monetary theory, which I've never bought into. You can grow your deficit, you know, as long as I think you're growing it slower than GDP, but you want to have those bullets in reserve for a recession. And the only thing that passes for bipartisan action in the U.S. right now is Democrats love social programs, Republicans love tax cuts, and the only bipartisan effort now is, okay, let's do both and explode the deficit and leave all of this debt for our kids and our grandkids. I'm very worried about the deficits.
You mentioned the news media a moment ago. To what extent do you think the news media is structured in such a way that it leads to bad things rather than good things?
Well, when I was growing up, the news used to be a public service of ABC and CBS, who were running the A-Team and Partridge Family, and thought we have a social obligation to run 30 minutes of news. 27 minutes will be news and 3 minutes will be opinion. And then someone noticed the 3 minutes of opinion was the most entertaining and most profitable, and they started going from 3 minutes to 27 minutes to 24 hours. And now we have a news cycle that starts with cable news that if it enrages you or tickles your tribal sensors, it'll keep you engaged. And then you take that with algorithms set on top of a profit incentive with social media, and you have media that takes everyone to extremes and makes us dislike each other. So I think the media has played a huge role in the polarization of our society, specifically social media, whose algorithms are like a fifth grade class during recess that surround you when there's two kids start having words and it says fight, fight, fight. Take that times a billion. It's pitting us against one another.
Tell us more about the algorithms. I think people are hearing a lot more about them lately, but you go into them at some length.
Well, it's simple. The algorithms they're benign. I mean, benign. They're indifferent, I should say. And that is, they're not left-leaning, they're not right-leaning, they lean towards green. And unfortunately, one of the unfortunate things about our species is that we're like a Tyrannosaurus Rex. We're drawn to movement and violence. And if you go on Twitter and say, that's an interesting point, I want to make a couple points and get your feedback because I disagree with you, that doesn't get as much engagement or as many likes as saying, you're an idiot and this is why. And so the algorithms promote that kind of incendiary, antagonistic content. So the more time you spend on social media, and now we're spending more time on social media than we are with traditional media, we start just disliking one another. And we end up in a situation where 54% of Democrats are worried about their kid marrying a Republican, and a third in each party see the other as their mortal enemy. And about a quarter of each party think that they would be okay with an autocrat as long as it was their guy or their gal. So the algorithms see that enragement equals an engagement, and their business models, engagement equals more Nissan ads and more revenue. So there's a direct profit incentive in polarization.
You were scheduled to do a show on CNN Plus until it got canceled. What about cable? And does cable have a future, or are we all now much more devoted to the internet?
Yeah, there'll be a business there, just like movie theaters or magazines or newspapers. It's just going to be a terrible place to work or invest. They're still very profitable. It's just they're shrinking. And I don't know what your viewing patterns are, but I've moved to London and I'm not sure I'll ever have cable television again. I can't even figure out where to go for it. And it's an ad-supported model, and advertising has become a tax that the technologically illiterate and the poor have to pay. The majority of people who have money or are technically literate can avoid ads. And when you watch cable ads right now, it's basically mostly seniors or poor people, and it's kind of an exercise in how much it sucks to get old or how much it sucks to be a poor person. The ads are for diabetes medication or for credit repair or hip replacement or Life Alert. And the younger generation, who's capturing more and more wealth and coming into the prime income earning years, consumes media, whether it's Spotify or, you know, YouTube Premium or Netflix, that doesn't have ads. So I think ad-supported television is under real threat. And it doesn't have the targeting capabilities of Meta that can tell you, can pinpoint a household in New Jersey that has a new driver in the household. So it's still very profitable. It'll be around for a long time. It'll just shrink slowly. So, you know, there are still Yellow Pages companies around. They're just not great places to work or invest right now.
You're in London. You've got the BBC, which is financed by the government and by tax support. And you've got Murdoch, who isn't. And which do you think is more significant, more important, more contributing to the culture of Britain, as far as you can tell?
I think they're both important. I think private and public supported media, just as I think socialized or public medicine and a private layer, I think they actually help each other. Or they work in concert, or they keep each other in check. So what's better, the BBC or privately owned media? You know, I would say the answer is yes. I think the idea of a public supported media that attempts to be, to kind of call balls and strikes and sort of hit it straight down the center, I think that's a good mission and has real benefits, and it's not ad-supported, leading them to kind of, it leads stories and try to discern the signal from the noise. But at the same time, profit-incentivized media, I think, plays a role too. They're going to have resources. They're going to cover different things in a different way. They're going to be more responsive to market trends. So I don't think it's an either-or. I think they both work. What we don't have in the U.S., I would argue, is really well-funded. I think the BBC is wonderful, and I find myself watching more and more of it, and I find that I consider myself a centrist, and the BBC feels that to me. Now, some people would argue it leans one way or the other, but I find it's a centrist viewpoint, and I like that.
Why'd you move to London?
You know, the honest answer is because we can, and people will ask, well, is it because of the Roe decision or violence in America or you're sick of America? It's not that at all. I didn't leave America because of America. I came to London because of America, and that is, I've had so many opportunities to do so many wonderful things and develop economic security in America that I have the opportunity to move to Europe for a few years where my parents grew up, expose my kids to a different culture. So I'm here because of America, but in a very positive way. I get to do something wonderful because of all the incredible opportunities that America provided me.
Back to the book, one of the things you suggest is that climate change could be an opportunity rather than an unmitigated disaster. What do you mean by that?
Well, whenever I think there's just a ton of great technology that could come out of this. I think whether it's a renewed interest in nuclear power, all of the amount of innovation and thought leadership and science going into trying to solve that problem, I think there'll be an enormous climate change dividend, if you will. I think it'll move to, you know, better jobs, cleaner jobs. So I think there's a lot of opportunity. I don't think it's, I think it'd be lazy to think that some MIT grad is going to come up with something to solve climate change and we'll all make trillions or billions of dollars. I think it's going to require massive coordination and public investment. But I don't know if you feel this way. I feel as if we've hit a tipping point, and that is everybody's talking about it. Almost everybody acknowledges it. People are thinking about their carbon footprint. I'm in London. It feels like there's more electric cars here than internal combustion engines. It feels as if we've hit a tipping point where everybody is thinking about this, not as an afterthought. They don't assign it as much with a hard left viewpoint. They see it as a centrist viewpoint. And it just feels as if there's an entire generation of smart, intelligent people who are not only cognizant of the problem, but are going to work really hard to address it. I was really excited about Biden's climate package. They're talking about reducing carbon emissions by 40% by 2030. I didn't even think that was possible. So, and I think it gives the world a reason to unite around a common issue. So I'm actually quite hopeful about it.
Well, it may or may not to be possible, but I don't want to make this an argument about nuclear power, but there are a lot of people who are saying that it's too expensive now to build new power stations, that the accidents that are possible now, particularly with aging reactors that are getting embrittled in their reactor protective areas, are simply too dangerous, and that you can't get rid of the waste. I mean, there are a lot of reasons for being concerned about nuclear power.
Yeah, I think a lot of that is a function of Hollywood, where we have Chernobyl on HBO, or we have the China Syndrome, or we have Monty Burns, the evil person runs a nuclear power plant. You could take all the nuclear waste that's been produced in the United States and put it in a container about 12 feet high, and it would cover the length. It would cover the size of a soccer field. I mean, it has to be managed carefully, but it's sort of, you know, pick your poison. And, some nations get 30-50% of the electricity from nuclear. And I would argue that the geopolitical instability, the carbon emissions, are a much bigger downside than nuclear. I don't think any serious conversation around climate change can happen without a more responsible, honest, sober conversation around the role nuclear plays, whether it's old plants or new plants. It just strikes me that nuclear has gotten a bad brand. We need to rebrand it. Maybe it's elemental power. But I think it's a technology that is going to play an instrumental role in combating climate change.
Fukushima, a very large area of Japan where nobody can live anymore?
We're talking about the majority of our kind of many of our coastal cities not being livable if we continue down the same path we are. So, I want to be clear. I think there's downsides to almost any energy. That is scalable and can actually produce the kind of energy we're going to need. But you're talking about one nuclear power plant can power a city the size of Philadelphia. So I would argue that the risks and the costs associated with that technology are dwarfed by the upside and the benefit.
Okay, once again, lively subject of controversy, let's put it that way.
Sounds like you're passionate about it. It sounds like it's something you're very interested in.
I've done a lot of stories on it, starting out a long time ago in the 70s, and so I followed it for a long period of time. And
do you think we should turn off Diablo?
I covered the opening of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant, and at the time they opened it, not realizing how many earthquake faults it was close to. Now it turns out it's right on top of one. They started out building the plant backwards and had to reverse the plans and do it over again. Once again, it's said to be that, said to, as I understand it, I'm no expert on it, but it said that the plant has now reached its age, or it will by 2025. And once again, that there is embrittlement of the reactor core that makes it more susceptible to shaking. And with all those earthquake faults, it's liable to have shaking. It seems to me dangerous. And there's also, you say that it's easy to store the waste. I think there's argument about that and how much actual space is needed for the waste. It's my understanding that there isn't any space left at Diablo Canyon. But again, I don't know the details. And I'm only hearing it from obviously people who are opposed to it. And I have talked to a lot of those people over a long period of time.
I think those are really excellent points. I look at the super fires that you're incurring in California. I look at the heat waves. I look at the drought. And I think that every month, realistically, on any actuarial basis, they're going to kill more people, cause more death, despair, disability, and economic harm than the risk proposed or presented by nuclear.
Okay, well, the argument
longer
is...
Longer conversation.
Yeah, and the argument is hot, and I'm glad it is. And it's a good one, I think, to have. I don't think we're having it often enough.
Yeah.
It was stirred up by Governor Newsom when he wanted to extend the life of Diablo Canyon, and he did it at the last minute in the legislative session when nobody knew what they were going to vote on, and really jammed it through. So that's an issue, too. The politics of it are very important.
You call it jammed it through. I call it leadership.
Leadership when elected officials don't know what they're voting on.
There you go.
I mean, I've covered Sacramento. I spent some time up there. And
is Sacramento governable? Can you do anything without jamming
things?
That's
a very good question.
I mean,
wait a minute. You just said the federal government was the most noble organization in the
I agree.
In the country. What about the government of California?
Well, look, you're going to forget more about this than I'm ever going to know. I think California is the fifth largest economy in the world. My sense is that special interest groups, it's been, I don't call it ungovernable, but it's become a difficult place to get things done. And the answer is always to spend more for less, is my sense. And that taxation, I don't think citizens are getting the return on their investment around taxes that they'd originally or they'd once received. And look, a longer conversation. I still think it's a wonderful state. I think it's the most beautiful state in the union, as goes California, as goes the nation, as our nation goes, as goes the world. But I mean, like I said, you cover a lot of this. It feels like Sacramento feels especially dysfunctional to me. But again, you cover it.
I think you're right. And I'm very concerned about it myself. I spent my whole life in California, although much of it also was in Washington, D.C. for a long time. I found it pretty dysfunctional in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, fair point. I think we have minority rule. I talk about this. You know, we have a situation where because of gerrymandering, districts are so hard left, so hard right, that the real election takes place in the primary. The general is basically a moot process in most of our congressional districts. The result is we have minority rule, and that is we have, you know, 30 senators from 5% of the population, and we have extremists on both sides. 41% of Americans now identify as independent because they're so turned off by Democrats and Republicans. And we have, you know, obviously the most obvious example is Roe. Roe just doesn't represent where America is. And until we have, I think, ranked choice voting, until we reject Citizens United, I think we're going to really struggle with this system that encourages dysfunction, not getting anything done, and incredible polarization. I also think we, and I talk about this in the book, national service would be a great idea for America. I think young people need more connective tissue. I think they need to see themselves as Americans first and foremost, not Republicans as Democrats. I think they need more opportunities to meet each other across income classes, to find friends, to find mates. I think they need to get out of their houses. The amount of contact we have, whether it's joining the Boy or the Girl Scouts, talking to our neighbors, playing in organized sports, has literally fallen off a cliff. And we're a social species, and I worry that young people need more contact with others and need to serve in the agency of something bigger than themselves, specifically our country.
You talk about how things have become institutionalized, and one of the institutions, of course, that's causing trouble is the Constitution and the way it's structured. And it seems to me it's utterly out of date, and yet there's nothing we can do about that.
Yeah, but we do have amendments. I mean, this is such a longer conversation. It's like it's my sense is, if I understand my history correct, it was meant as a guide, not as a suicide pact. And they just could have never imagined this world. Again, another conversation that's a much longer conversation, but I find that both parties use the Constitution opportunistically, kind of pull it out. You know, parties want state rights when it benefits them, then when they don't like the federal law, and then they want a federal law when they see an opportunity. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think it's almost become hard to use as in an effective conversation.
Back to the book, Chapter 10, What We Must Do. You suggest simplifying the tax system, rebuilding the regulatory system, working it out so that big-time criminals such as heads of the of corporations are actually deterred by individual punishment rather than not, and rethinking incarceration, a lot of interesting ideas, rebranding nuclear, which we've already talked about, and also supporting children and family formation. Are all of those things, even if we could accomplish them all, really enough to take care of the problems that face us, particularly given climate?
I think so. I just think I think her name's Maria Amalo. I keep forgetting her name. She's this wonderful photographer of the New York Times that's been colorizing World War II photos. And she has this amazing photo of a landing craft that just let its front bridge down. And you see all these young men, their average age was 26. On an inflation-adjusted basis, they were making $800, wading into the water, heading towards Omaha Beach, where two or three of them wouldn't make it off the beach. And I imagine them looking back and somehow being able to see through space and time and seeing us and our problems now. And I imagine they would just say to us, well, you can't figure that out. You can't figure out polarization of your media. You can't figure out income inequality. Look what I'm facing. Look at the sacrifices I'm making and what I'm about to overcome here. So I go back to the Bill Clinton quote. I don't think there's anything wrong with America that can't be fixed with what's right with America. We created a regressive tax structure. We can create, go back to a more progressive tax structure. We used to make huge, bold investments in technology and in the middle class and in our youth through public education that paid off huge dividends. We used to be, you know, we used to see each other as Americans first and foremost. I think we've fallen into this crazy, unfortunate falsehood or we fail to recognize Americans' greatest allies will always be other Americans. And so I think all of these problems, my first book, The Four, was about technology. It started out optimistically. And as I learned more about these companies, it became a cautionary tale. And I became very pessimistic about big tech. As I started really looking at the problems of failing young men, income inequality, climate change, I think all of these things are absolutely addressable. Look what we managed to do with the pandemic. I mean, we have a lot of hard questions to ask ourselves, but the record development of these vaccines have saved somewhere between 1 and 2 million American lives. And no one's lining up to buy Chinese or Russian vaccines. That was American ingenuity, American supply chain, American investment. So I come out of this book thinking we face enormous problems. That's the bad news. The good news is there is absolutely nothing that's bigger than what we have than what we have faced before.
I will give you the last word. Speaking to us from London, the book again is Adrift, America in 100 Charts. We haven't had time to talk about the charts, but we can't see them on the podcast anyway. So, Scott Galloway, great to talk with you. Come back, join us again.
I like that. Thanks for your good work. I love KCRW. I grew up with it.
The producer of To the Point is Andrea Brody, with help from Anna Buss. Our engineer is John Meek. I'm Warren Olney. Thanks very much for listening, and join us again.